Do you get ribbed about your name, or you must have to answer for your name a lot?
I used to a great deal. Used to be I couldn't walk in a room and introduce myself without everyone laughing, and I got lots of Tootsie jokes for many years, as you can imagine. But, you know, now my students have no idea who Dustin Hoffman is.
There you go.
It's a little sad, but...
Wait out a generation. Hey, he's still around, though. But yeah, we'll see if you can overcome him in fame. You're on your way with this wonderful book, Hundred Knuckled Fist. I love the title, too. I couldn't figure it out until I got through the story. So why do you suppose writers so rarely seem to write about the working class, the blue-collar worker, which is what you've done with these stories?
Well, I guess my theory on this is that we often come to fiction for escapism. You know, we want to see some kind of life that is more interesting than our own, maybe a little more opulent than our own, or something surreal or fantastic. But I think this is a mistake a lot of, especially the writers I teach, make, that readers are actually very interested in this world, and there can be escapism in the 9-to-5 as well. I just think it's one we don't imagine right away, because we want to get away from our 9-to-5s and this boring drudgery of work that we do. So that's one theory I have on it, at least.
You know, I've often thought when I watch TV that all the shows are lawyers and doctors and police officers. Why don't we pay more attention to the blue-collar worker? You know, their lives are just as interesting. And you certainly have shown that. And you've done some of that yourself. Was it 10 years as a painter?
Yeah, I spent 10 years painting houses. And probably about 7 of those years, it was full-time, you know, 40 to 70 hours a week. Of course, in Michigan, it was feast or famine.
Yeah.
It's pretty common in the Midwest. The winters, we really would slow down. But yeah, I spent quite a bit of time. And it was an interesting time to be doing construction as well. I was doing it up until 2007, so right up against that housing bubble, the recession, and kind of near the end of my career, 2004 to 2006, we couldn't build houses fast enough. I was doing like new residential construction. There weren't enough workers. We couldn't put up those houses fast enough. And then a weird thing happened, like just as I was leaving, but we all know now, those houses went into foreclosure, and whole subdivisions would have, you know, for sale signs out front or foreclosure signs. Which I'm glad I got out of it, but a lot of my friends lost their jobs. And in some ways, it was like a little sense of guilt that I had a piece of this, you know, helping build these kind of irresponsible houses. So anyway, that's kind of really drawn me into this world. It's fascinated me and kind of haunted me, too, especially how this work disappeared in those recession years.
And what do you think about the importance of work in developing our identities, our personalities? Because, you know, a lot of times you hear these sayings of you're not what you do. And I've always puzzled over that, because I've thought, you know, I don't know that we can separate it. If we bring any kind of passion to our work, surely it does somehow intersperse with who we are. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think work is completely formative for character in fiction, at least. As a fiction writer, I think about it, and what better way to show a character than them at work, where they're doing something? You know, there's that old phrase of making a living. That's one I think about a lot. How could this not be so much of who you are when it's how you survive? And
exactly, yeah.
Take care of yourself and your family and all of that. But I think it's in the doing. In this action that we especially find ourselves. Joseph Conrad has a great quote from Heart of Darkness, which now I don't have on hand, but it goes something like, no one can really know a man. It's all in the work, and it's how you find yourself in this work, which I've always found fascinating. Like, no one knows you except yourself at work in this moment of doing this thing.
Yeah, and there's that theme of invisibility that you've worked with, too, in the sense that, you know, and right now with politics going on, we're talking about that a lot, too, the 99%. There's a lot of us out there sweating it out every day. What is it that makes that part of our society so invisible?
Well, here's my other favorite quote about work, which is at the front of my book from George Orwell. And so he says, all people who work with their hands are partly invisible, and the more important the work they do, the less visible they are. Hmm. And, you know, that was true all those years ago. And I think it's all the more true now. The answer to why this invisibility happens, I'm not sure. Orwell was interested in exploring it. I think that's a reason why I had to write this book, is I'm still trying to figure out this mystery as well. Like, why these people that are so essential and important, why we don't give them a closer look or more recognition. Yeah, it speaks to all of us. I mean, who is not trying to be recognized for the hard work that they do? Who doesn't want to find that recognition? I think the difference, though, is at least with these people building houses, I worked with a lot of, I'd call them artists, fantastic craftsmen, but they never got to put their signature on everything. And if you're good at what you do, no one should know you were ever there. And that was the goal. Like with a painter, you caulk and fill all the nail holes and roll the walls out with this perfect texture so that no one can ever notice a brush stroke or a roller mark. You know, you are completely invisible if you've done your job correctly.
That's a good point. That's a good point. If we're thinking about you, you probably messed up on something.
Yeah.
Or is it, I wonder too, is it a thing that we don't really want to look in the mirror? That maybe they're closer to the grit of life? And, you know, we probably have more facades and masks as we move up that social ladder, and they show us who we really are? Or am I getting too deep here?
Oh, I like it, Zinta. I think you're on to something. I found, you know, I'm in academia now. You know, I've been teaching for since 2007, and I love this world. I would not go back to the other world. But at times, I miss the frank honesty, the gritty crassness, the lack of worrying about anyone's feelings in a way, and that got us to be really close with the people I worked with. But yeah, there are definitely a lot less masks, and it really all gets kind of torn down when you're working next to one person doing this very difficult manual labor for, you know, maybe 14 hours in a row. So yeah, it might be a little closer to, well, you can't hide anything. I guess that's what it is.
Yeah.
14 hours of doing this, you know, there's no time to be politically correct, or it's all going to spill out at some point. And I do, I miss that a little bit, but I can come back to it in my fiction.
In fact, your opening story right away intrigued me. You handled some very touchy social issues there, and these guys were really open with each other, and you'd expect them to just be at each other's throats and kill each other, but they don't. There's an interesting dynamic there.
And that was an important story for me too. And I was kind of, I came at it with a question of, what if a character came out as gay in this very masculine environment? And I hadn't seen this exact thing play out, but kind of everything gets normalized in this horror of crassness.
Yeah.
But there's a nice camaraderie in that too. Although it might not look like it from the surface, if you were to walk on this crew onto a crew, sometimes folks may have done this, to walk past a crew, and the language sounds quite intense and severe. But I think there's like a language of camaraderie and real intimacy there as well. Of course, there are people that in this world that are violent and are unaccepting. But at least I think with this story, I wanted the reader to see that those people can't make it in this world, as probably they can't in a lot of other worlds. If you're not open to, you know, accepting how others live, then, you know, you're not going to be able to be a part of the group or the big 100 knuckled fist.
No, you captured it wonderfully, that dynamic. I'm wondering, too, about place, Midwest. I mean, when we talk about invisibility, a lot of literature is East Coast, West Coast, you know, but not a lot of it deals with the Midwest. And maybe that's changing. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it is. I think we're seeing more and more Midwest authors. And, you know, of course, there's Iowa with the Iowa Writers Workshop.
True.
Right there, the flyover state. So at least, you know, people are coming there, and that's become quite a center. And I'm lucky to have studied at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo.
With Jamie Gordon, right?
Yes, yeah. She was my mentor, and I owe her everything. She was the first one who, one of the first people who said, like, you have to keep writing these work stories. Mm. Her hands are kind of all over this book in a lot of ways, and good influence. But yeah, for a while, and still right now, Jamie Gordon was out of Kalamazoo, and Stuart Dybeck was living and writing there quite a bit. Bonnie Jo Campbell was right there, and now Thisbe Nissen is on the faculty at Western, and she is a phenomenal writer too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and people were looking. Bonnie Jo was a National Book Award nominee, and then Jamie Gordon won the National Book Award pretty close together. So I do think folks are looking out there, although I'm worried this year about the National Book Award.
Worried?
Yeah.
How's that?
Well, and I haven't looked at all the regions, but it's all novels, no short story collections this year. And it's pretty much like the big five publishers are the only ones on the list. And there are great novels, great names on there. But, you know, of course, I'm always concerned about recognition for the short story and the Midwest, which has maybe historically been ignored.
Dustin, you've gotten a prize yourself. Let's toot our horn on that one. In fact, I read somewhere that you ran around the house screaming and frightening your two-year-old daughter when it happened. So tell us that story.
Yeah, there was much screaming, and dancing and, I think, the next time, an award is won, they may just all go hide in the basement or, well, now we're in South Carolina. There are no basements in South Carolina, but they may all go hide somewhere. Yeah, it was shocking, thrilling, exciting to win the award. And, then there's this weird reaction of, and this, you probably read about this as well, but of disbelief. And I tell my students, this is like part of being a writer is self-doubt and like wondering if somebody made a mistake and thinking that your work was good and your work is deserving of winning. But, you know, once then the proofs in the galleys come and like, okay, I guess they're going to stick with this. But, well, thank you for bringing that up. I should remember, that at least the Prairie Schooner Award and University of Nebraska Press is doing a great job of recognizing the working class.
Well,
and
there you go. And that's a pretty big prize, too, I have to say. So short stories, you've just told us how important that is to you, but I hear rumors that you're working on a novel now. What are you working on, and how is that different, and are you going to abandon short stories or just taking a break here?
No, I'm back to short stories already. I just finished off a couple more recently after a summer of working on the novel, and I love that form so much, the short story. I don't think I'll ever leave it. Mm. This novel is set in my hometown of Elma, Michigan, which is right in the center of the Mitten, and they have a little liberal arts college there, but mostly I'd say it's a very working class town. It used to have Total Refinery and Dow Chemicals, and although those the refinery's gone at this point, a lot of the jobs are gone there. So that was interesting to me. It speaks to my themes of that kind of invisibility of working class, but I'm looking at teenagers during the winter who aren't yet a part of this working world, but are very affected by it. So that was interesting to me. But as far as the short story form and the novel form goes, I may be cheating. I don't know. With this novel, I found myself thinking of like each chapter as having an arc like a short story. So it's almost, I don't know. I may have just patched together a bunch of short stories.
You know, that's the novel and stories. That's a format that here at Between the Lines, I'm coming across that more and more often. That almost seems to be a new trend.
Maybe. I do really love that form. Although, you know, even Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example.
As a novel and stories. So there were some great writers doing that a long time ago. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what to call this thing. I guess it was just whatever can get you through this kind of swimming out at sea process of writing the novel. For me, it was coming back to the short story form, thinking about, you know, like a unified effect and making everything work together rather than I tried to never let it meander, which, you know, I think the best novelists avoid that anyway. They come at it with that short story craft and aesthetic of we need to get somewhere quickly. Everything must structurally work together. So I don't know. I hope it worked out with the novel, but we'll wait and see.
Yes. Well, wait, and you'll have to come back.
Oh, I'd love that.
Before I let you go, Dustin, I'd love for you to read just a little excerpt so that we can get a taste of that fine writing.
I would be happy to do that. I was thinking I'd read the first three paragraphs. They're pretty short ones. This would be the first three paragraphs of 100 Knuckled Fist. We tore up the earth in the yard of a three-story, 4,000-square-footer in Swinging Willow subdivision. We backhoed a gash through the silky sod, brown like a week-old scab, red at the center. That hole in the Glavin family's front lawn was a big dig, so deep it split us into pieces, and we were never right again. We were making a fountain, the Glavins willing to shell out 15 grand to piddle a Zen waterfall down their front lawn's downgrade, to sparkle diamonds in their eyes from the big bay window large as the sky. They could have just looked outside from 7 to 5 and seen our half dozen torsos, bare chests gleaming sweat, pocked with clay. Because we dug earth, because we heaved shovels, because we hauled it away in the back of Rex's not so shiny 92 Dodge Ram, our skin never stopped sparkling. We couldn't tear away enough layers to cool down. No one works harder than the hardscaping boys. Won't catch us snipping copper and tugging carpet and swinging brushes inside an air-conditioned house. So I'll stop there.
Great, great stuff. And from now on, when I hear the name Dustin Hoffman, I promise I'll think of you.
Right, I like it. Now he's the other Dustin Hoffman.
There you go. Thanks for talking with us today, Dustin.
Thank you, Zinta.